A new song for an old, stubborn creation today.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Another psalm today, Psalm 96. These 13 verses are really interesting for a read to me. Hopefully they will be to you too, I will say. I think they will be. They are fascinating to me for a reason that's completely different than the other psalms have been interesting to me. I love when a psalm refers specifically to a period of time, you know, like David when he was fleeing Saul in the wilderness, as we've talked about with a couple of the psalms, or David after his sin with Bathsheba. It's so obvious and easy then to go to those stories and make sure that we're reading the psalm in the light of the story that the psalm wants us to know it's related to. I love that. What I find fascinating about this psalm is that it is easy and obvious to put it into the historical context, to put something of it into the historical context of David's life in particular, because there is a passage in David's historical record in Scripture that actually uses this psalm almost exactly, almost word for word, almost word for word. So there's no way that we wouldn't apply that psalm to this reading as well, that passage in 1 Chronicles. It's 1 Chronicles 16. But it's not quite the same. And the changes make it pretty obvious that it should be applied in a not a completely different way, but in a significantly different way. And that's what makes the psalm fascinating, and that's what I want to share with you as we're going through it. So the question, basically, about the psalm that I won't dwell on as a question, I'm not going to try to make huge historical arguments about it. I'm going to make a textual argument about it by the time we get to the end, but that'll be short. The basic background question or options that we have are that it is David's psalm from when he brought the ark back to Jerusalem in 1 Chronicles 16. They march in, and a part of the song that they sing in 1 Chronicles 16 are the words of this psalm. That's what comes out. And all you got to do is go read it and see how obvious it is. I will read it to you at the end of the time that we're talking today from that passage. The other, depending on how much time we have, I might read the whole thing to you. But the other option we have is that it's not from David. Because of the changes that are in it, and I'll show you the changes and why we would make this argument, there are just minor changes, just a phrase here and there, a piece of vocabulary here or there, that it is actually after the temple has been rebuilt and they have returned from the captivity. And because of all the language about the other nations and the way they're described and the comments about the gods that are being discussed, it does seem to me like it probably falls into the category of the latter, that it is a post-exilic, as people would say, psalm, and that it's given to us to sing in that light because of the different meaning it would have for people who are returning from the nations than it would have for the people who have now conquered the nations and possessed the land that God has given them, and so on. So let's take a quick look at the psalm. The first six verses, it is in three pieces. I think it's pretty obvious structurally that the psalm is divided into these three pieces. It could be arguable that you could take out a verse here or there, whatever. But we're just going to take it this way. Verses 1-6 obviously flow together. You'll see it as I'm reading through it, I think, that they all flow together. And then verses 7-10, they say something a little different. And then verses 11-13 fit together. Okay, and it's a progression. I think it's a pretty straightforward progression. So starting in verse 1, it says this, "Oh, sing to the Lord a new song." Now, there is a bias we'll bring to the last half of this verse, so it's going to talk about the earth, but But I want you to hear it with the bias, but I also want you to hear it knowing, I wonder what else that could mean. And it's not difficult to understand what it would mean. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to Yahweh is the Lord in almost all of this psalm. Sing to the Lord, bless his name, tell of his salvation from day to day. Declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works among all the peoples. For great is Yahweh, the Lord, and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the peoples are worthless idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Now, there is a power to this that just goes with reading it without any background whatsoever, and even without the, I think, explanations that I'm about to give to it. Our God is the creator. We have a reason to celebrate him no matter where we are, no matter what we're doing, and it's worth singing every single day throughout the entire earth. If we just said that, we would have something worth saying about God. No problem with that whatsoever. But it's a little more precise than that, and it's also a little stronger statement than that, I think, when it's understood a little more carefully. So the number one part of this is to understand the end of verse 1. The end of verse 1 is where it said, sing to the Lord all the earth. We immediately, just because of our, I don't want to say scientific, but our modern perspective, we almost automatically capitalize the word earth and turn it into the name of our globe. And it is reasonable to understand that when they use the word earth, that they're using it with the same kind of dualistic sense that we use it. Yeah, it's the ground, the earth. I want to put my hands into the earth and feel the earth between my fingers. That stuff that I would never say without a pair of gloves on, but whatever. You don't have to know all my weaknesses, but that's one of them. You might as well know. But the other option is that we are talking about the whole place where we live, you know, the ground, which obviously is identified with the dirt that's down there because that's what we live on, the dirt. And so we've made the earth and the earth the same thing. And there's no doubt they expanded in the same way historically that the word is used to refer to the whole place where people are, where we live on the land, and to the land itself. But in this case, and not just in this case, in reality, the language that's being used here, when it says earth, it's talking about the land. And so if it were to describe something being the tallest mountain in the earth, it wouldn't be saying the tallest mountain on the globe. It would be saying the tallest mountain in this land. And it's this land. In all the earth means in all the land. That's the land that God has given to Israel. And the fact that he is speaking this to Israel seems obvious because of the words he says, sing to the Lord, bless his name, tell of his salvation, declare his glory among the nations, his marvelous works, among all the peoples. All those other peoples, all those other nations need to hear it. They hear it from this people, those who do belong to Yahweh. So Israel, in the first section of the psalm, is to tell the nations about Yahweh. And what they're to say to the nations is that our God, you know, the people of Yahweh, Israel, their God, is greater than all the gods the other nations worship. For great is Yahweh and greatly to be praised. He's to be feared above all the gods. For all the gods of the peoples are worthless idols. But Yahweh, he made the heavens. Now, there's a weight in that passage that we think of, I think, coming only from the idea that he's the creator and that's cool. He's the creator. Again, that's enough, and that makes the point. But in their world, there was a different way of thinking of the gods that made this statement and the fact that they're paired together as parts of the same, as this part of the poem in verse 5, as this couplet, for all the gods of the people are worthless idols. But the Lord made the heavens. There's a part of that that just says, you know, God isn't carved from a tree You know, in the way Isaiah makes fun of the idols. You cut down a tree and then you worship it and you say, oh, here are gods. And you burn a fire and you cook food over the rest of your God. It doesn't make any sense and it's ridiculous. And we would be saying, in contrast to that, you cut little pieces of the creation out and you say, oh, look, our gods. But our God created everything. He's not a part of creation. And that is, again, a sufficiently strong contrast. But if this psalm is written in the latter context that I talked about, then the contrast between the gods that the people around them worshiped and the God that they know Yahweh to be is even a little stronger, or at least the statement to them, if you're in my sort of sarcastic mood all the time, it's more insulting to them. If you're in the mood of, you know, a proper Christian, and I mean that, a proper Christian, then it's just a greater statement about how much better Yahweh is, because, you know, you have to keep in mind that this statement is, Yahweh isn't like the God of the nations. Why not? Well, think about the gods of the nations. And I'll just give you the example. I'm going to use the Greek gods. And I know you might say to yourself, oh, you know, that's a little later than this. Actually, it's not. Hesiod is writing the Theogony, which is a record of how people had been talking about the origin of the gods. He writes that in the 8th century BC. So that's when their captivities would be taking place, and only 100 years after David. And again, that's a written record of their historical tradition. So this would apply to the way people in the Levantine coast, in Greece, in the Mediterranean basin altogether, and all over the Middle East thought about their gods. And it's apparent in the shared mythologies that they have. There are other myths that share similar attributes to what I'm about to describe to you. They're not all identical. They don't all come from exactly the same place. But because I think it's written later, even, like in the post-exilic period, or at least compiled in that period, meaning closer to the Hellenistic era in the Mediterranean basin, then it would make perfect sense for them to create a contrast with the Greek gods, and more particularly the kinds of myths that were associated with them. What am I talking about? Okay, so, you know, where does Zeus come from? You know, the Greek gods, the story of the Greek gods. And I'm not saying that you would take this directly to Zeus, but I'm saying use this as a background for how Asher or Tiamat or Marduk, the Babylonian god, or any of them could have been worshipped, right? So in the Greek god history, the one that I'm most familiar with, it's easy to describe where everything comes from. You start out with these primordial, or whatever you want to call them, forces that are not gods, but they're like, you know, they're primordial forces. They're the things that exist first, the chief among which are Uranus and Gaia. We've all heard of these. Uranus, the name of the planet, right? Outside of Pluto or inside of Pluto, depending on where their orbits are at a given moment or whatever. So Uranus, and then Gaia, the Mother Earth, you know, the idea of geography, Gaia. And so Uranus and Gaia, in the myth that's carried around the Mediterranean basin all over the place, in the myth, the sky, Uranus, and Gaia, the land, they come together. They are a couple. They're like married, right? And so you can imagine, I mean, the rain creates a perfect model of fertility to illustrate what happens here. And Uranus and Gaia come together and they have offspring. And the offspring are the Titans. And the Titans have their offspring. And so in particular, the two big Titans, big, are Cronos and Rhea, or Cronos and Rhea. And Cronus and Rhea, who have their own interesting story to be told about why they're called what they are, Cronus having to do with this spiral of time or the cutting off of things, that things are, you know, they pass and they move on to the next thing. And Cronus is doing that. I mean, he's, you know, he wants to kill his own offspring, by the way. And Rhea, his own offspring being Zeus, by the way. But Rhea, you know, has to do with like rivers flowing, you know, the flowing water, the waters that flow, or just a current in general. And so the opposite. And so those two things are having offspring, and that's the gods, all the different gods, and also some monsters of the Titans that follow, and you know some of that mythology. But even if you don't, what you do know is this. Cronus and Rhea have Zeus, whom Rhea protects, and Zeus kills all the Titans, and then, or at least wins the battle with the Titans. And then Zeus is the great god. Zeus is the mighty god. And who created Zeus? The heavens. Uranus. You know, that's who created Zeus. So you can imagine how powerful a statement it is in an entire region that has that kind of mythology in their mind to say all gods of the peoples, they're worthless idols. Yahweh, he made the heavens. It's a powerful supplanting of these false gods who are fascinating stories and interesting ways to talk about where the rivers or the streams or this nation or that came from. But they don't grasp the reality of the one God who created the heavens and the earth and everything that's in them. And so the last line then, splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. Are an opportunity then to bow down before the one true God in a place that's worthy of worshiping him. You know, the land that he's given to them to occupy. And so all the earth should be singing this praise before him. And here's the thing. They're not being given this statement. And if you think about this in the post-exilic sense, it's even more profound. But even in the sense in which David would have said it in 1 Chronicles 16, sung it with the people there, it's profound that they're not using their God, Yahweh. They're not using the power of their God, even the way Eli had allowed the ark to be used when it was carried into battle. Oh, we're going to use our God to defeat the other nations. That's not what this God is like. He's not out to join your army. We know that with Joshua when he comes before God. Even when God is defeating an enemy, it's not so he can join your team. It's not because he's limited to your nation. The whole point of this is that in these first six verses, we already see them not using their God to defeat the nations, but to recognize that Yahweh is the creator of all of the nations. They inhabit part of the ground that was created by him. All of the ground was created by him, but he's given them their part of the ground. And they're singing together in this part of the land to indicate that there are people who occupy the land that was made by him, this peace that was given by him, and who know that he's the one who created it and made things the way they are. And so what they're declaring is that he's God over everyone, not just over a handful of people. There is nothing that resonance, that song is supposed to go out everywhere. That's why in the middle of this section it says, declare his glory among the nations. So last weekend I was down where some of my other family live, my in-laws live and stuff. And I have an aunt down there that told us a really funny story. We were together. And her story was when she was in London, because we're going to be going to London before long and have a visit there. And she was, I went to London and these great things. Oh, I got arrested in London. That's how her story started. This is an octogenarian aunt. She's a wonderful, just lively, vivacious, really great person. And got, you know, she's just great. And so she had no problem getting around London doing all this stuff. I mean, she's an active, energetic person. And so she's in London. And so she tells us the story of how she gets arrested. Now, I will say arrested is a strong term for this. She got detained, but she did get detained and like carried off by the police. So that's the part of what happens with her. So, and it doesn't involve any alcohol or anything like that. She's not that kind of person. Okay, so what happened was first of all, she just tells us about the day. So they go about to do their stuff. I can't remember what all the stuff is, but it involves getting on the tube. They may have gone to see Buckingham Palace. They may have gone to, you know, whatever, the Tower of London, the bridge or whatever. I don't know. They went to a bunch of stuff, saw the river, saw the whatever. And they're doing touring. It's her and her husband and another guy that's a son-in-law that they have that's with them. And maybe somebody else is with them, but those are with her for sure. Anyway, they're traveling around all day, and they notice at some point that there's this really obnoxious sound in town. And it's a sound they didn't expect to be there, but no matter where they go, it's there. So they just figure it's something in the background, kind of a nuisance. And it's even, I mean, it's louder at some points and not louder at other points. I mean, even when they get on the tube. I'm not just talking about out on the streets, there must be some siren going off or something. And it's like that. It's like a siren is going off, you know? And so they're all over town. They hear it, and they don't think anything about it. So they finally go to St. Paul's Cathedral. They get there, and there's some kind of prayer service, some kind of meeting going on. There are people in St. Paul's Cathedral, you know, this sacred space, St. Paul's Cathedral. And so they go in the sanctuary, and they're in there, and they still hear the noise, and it's louder than ever. And so they're walking around, and finally they see the police making a beeline to them. And the police come to them, and they take them outside, and they say, "We're going to need to see what's in your purse." And she says, "It's just some necessities, you know. I mean, this is, you know, it's just my aunt. She's not a threat to St. Paul's Cathedral." And they take out this device, and it's making the noise. It's been making the noise all day. And, you know, when she tells us this part of the story, she looks at us and says, "And, you know, it was funny because it did seem like it was following us around all day." It's like, yeah, I think it was following you around. Her son-in-law had given her a security device, you know, something to press a button on in case she was attacked or something happened if she was alone somewhere. And then people would come running to help because it was that loud and obnoxious. And in her purse, she hadn't recognized that it was going on and went going off. And it went off all day. And she's on the tube, you know, in a car full of people who are going down the subway, you know, and nobody's telling her. And she's walking around with her husband, and they don't figure out it's coming from her purse. I guess people couldn't tell, but the police could when they realized it was there, and they carried her out of the church. Anyway, the reason I'm telling you that is that's who we're supposed to be in the world. Not because we're obnoxious, not because we're arrogant. I don't mean that part of it. But I mean, there is supposed to be a presence with us that just can't be ignored. It's a noise that we're making. It's the sound of this song, this chorus, when we're singing this song together. Israel's presence in the land was not intended to be just a silent tool in a purse that's closed. Let's occupy the land of Israel, close the borders, make sure it's sealed up at the top, and then nobody hears us. They're not singing their songs for that reason. They're on top of a mountain so that their song can be heard by everyone. In Jesus' words, you don't put a light on top of a, you don't light a candle so you can cover it under a bushel. You put a light on top of a thing so that everyone can see it. And he puts a light on top of a mountain, as he describes it, so everyone can see the light. That's Jerusalem. That's what they're supposed to be. We're supposed to be making a noise that's so obvious that the rest of the world has to see it. And when we invade their sanctuary, it should make them a little uncomfortable. And not because we're being obnoxious, but just because we're saying the truth about Yahweh. And not obnoxious truth, not, "Ooh, look how terrible you are," but simply, "Oh, have you seen Yahweh made the heavens?" I mean, this is profound. And do you see what he's done to us and for Israel to have been that kind of people? I mean, that's their calling. That's what God wants them to be. And the psalm is simply saying, that's who I want you to be in this land. That's who I want you to be. And if you put that in the post-exilic context, well, we'll talk about it at the end. And that's why it would make sense for it to be a new song there, which we'll talk about at the end as well. So that's the first section. The second section is verses 7 through 10. And, you know, what happens here is that he starts telling the nations what they need to do. So, and I'm saying he starts telling them, it's the song. So as the people of Israel are singing, they're now turning outward to say to everyone else, join us. Join us in the song. Do you hear this song? Ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples. This is the peoples are, you know, Israel is the people of God. It's using that word, M. It's using the word to say we're the people of God. Now, all the other peoples, all the families, meaning this isn't about national boundaries. It's just about whoever you're with, whoever's language you speak, whoever was your father and your grandfather and all the kinsmen that you have together. O families of the peoples, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory that's due to his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. We'll talk about that lower down, why it says come into his courts. Obviously, it's a reference to coming into the temple to offer a sacrifice. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness. Tremble before him, all the earth. Say among the nations, and this time I think they mean the earth where you are, the land where you are. So God gave us this little piece of land, and we're singing from it, but now all the lands occupied by all the families of all the peoples should be singing this and trembling before him. Say among the nations, so among the nations, whether that's a reference to when they were in captivity or if it's to all the peoples of all the nations saying this to all the nations. The Lord reigns. Yes, the world is established. It shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Now, if you take that, that's verse 10. The three verses right before that, verses 7 through 9 that I just read to you, tremble before him all the earth, worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness, and so on. All that section in verses 7 through 9. You know, I think the contrast that's intended, and if it's post-exilic, there's no doubt, even in David's day, it might be the point. The contrast is with worshiping the false gods of the nations that are around them. So worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness and tremble before him all the earth. If you wanted to put it in a context that makes it obvious, and by the way, let me add to that. When I say it's a contrast with worshiping the false gods, you have to remember that the false gods are often identified with whoever the king is in that land that worships that god. And so Nebuchadnezzar becomes uncomfortably related to Marduk. Or, you know, Sennacherib becomes uncomfortably related to Asher, and his descendants start claiming to be that god over time. The point is that you're forced to worship these false gods or these kings as if they are gods, and it's just not adequate. And so if you want to put it in an immediate comparative context, you think of Daniel 3 and the giant image that's built, the golden statue that's raised, and Nebuchadnezzar says, when you hear all those instruments, I've memorized them, but I'm not going to say them right now. Then bow down before the whatever, and Daniel and his compadres won't do it. And then they end up in the fiery furnace because they stood up to say, we only worship one God, and we're not going to worship a false one. And our God's able to protect us. It's the same kind of declaration. You have idols, you have vain images, you have things you think are splendid, but they're nothing compared with the God who created the heavens. So that's in verses 7 through 9. The other part that I think is really important about this is why he says, the Lord reigns, and then says, yes, the world is established. You know, the world, and it shall never be moved. That kind of metaphorical language we've talked about before, there are metaphors. Obviously, the earth is going to be moved. It's going to be melted one day, you know, and replaced with the new earth or made into the new earth. That's some movement there, you know. So it moves. That's not the point. The point is that from our perspective, it doesn't. It's like eternal. And so he's using the thing that is fixed from the perspective of the reader so that he can make the point of what's eternal for them regarding God. And the way he describes it has to do with God's judgment and specifically the word equity. And so even without the people of the nations having the Ten Commandments or Yahweh having met with them on Sinai and established a covenant or given them a land or so on, even without all of that, they do have the testimony of this world telling them that if you worship a God you can see, if you worship a God made of gold, if you worship a God who sits on a throne you could burn or you could take him off of, then you're a fool because everything in this world says things are going to be equal. And that means your king isn't any greater than you are. Let me explain what I mean by the metaphors that are present throughout Scripture. The metaphors are all about equity. They're about leveling things out. That's built into the world. Mountains and valleys become level. Rocks roll down from the mountain, fill the valley, make the mountain shorter until the rough places are plain, to use the words of Isaiah, or in all the anticipation we have of John the Baptist leading the way for Jesus. If there's an abundance, there's going to be a drought. That's the even in the dream that Joseph has in Egypt. Everyone knows. You don't just say, oh, it rained this year. It's always going to rain. We're never going to have without. When you have abundance, you know. You harvest and you prepare for the time when you're going to have a drought. The earth levels things out. If there is summer, then there will be winter one day a year in Texas, but it comes regardless. There's always going to be that leveling out. We talk about it all the time. I talk about it when I'm doing funerals. If sure enough, today it is winter, but after every single winter, we know the spring is going to come and the plants are going to bloom again, and the sky is going to turn blue, and things are going to be different. Everything levels out that way in this world. The world's testimony, that doesn't mean the world is declaring something that makes it obvious who God is and what he's done to redeem us. People can make that argument. We have that discussion another day. You may take C.S. Lewis's approach on it. It's fine. I kind of like his approach on it. All fine. That's not the point here. The point in this passage is that the earth itself and its permanence gives this testimony that if you worship something less than the creator of all other things, you're not worshiping a thing that's good enough for you, because all those other things you worship are no better than you are. How do we know it? Because of the actuality of leveling that takes place. Not just the metaphors, mountains and valleys and abundance and drought and summer and winter, but the actuality of leveling that happens when the earth opens up its mouth and swallows a person no matter how high they have climbed on the mountain. Just doesn't matter how high you go. You're coming back down, and you're going to be in the ground. At that moment, I mean, that is the great equalizer, right? That's the point. We all go to the grave together. And in that moment, you would think everybody would look down and go, I was worshiping that. What was I thinking? Or you would think a person looking down at that grave at someone who has worshiped previously would say to themselves, wait, I want people to worship me and I'm going to be like that? Why would I ask for that? And know that it's just not the right approach today. Okay, so we got the idea. So in verses 7 through 10, I'll say it to you this way, because again, I think it is in the temple, in the context of the temple. What Israel had in the temple, what Israel saw in the splendor of worshiping God in that holy place in Jerusalem, the nations have in the world. They have this land that declares for them in the nature of its permanence in comparison with their transience, an invitation to look for something better to worship, to look for something higher and greater to worship, that he will judge the peoples with equity, is how verse 10 ended. Then in verses 11 through 13, we get the final statement of it. And in this, everything is invited to join in, but it's invited to join in a way that emphasizes why it is we're worshiping him to begin with and why it's worth worshiping him. Not only because he created everything, but because, in the language that I normally use for it and that a lot of us use for it, we would say, but also because he sustains it. But in this case, it's not just the middle ground sustaining of what's going on right now. It's the fact that he has never taken his hand off because he created it. And because of that, we know he will judge things, make them right in the end. And so in verse 11, let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar. That covers it all. The heavens, the earth, the sea. We've talked about this. That's the cosmology that they have. The things that are above, the things where we are, the things below us. That's all there is in the universe. Let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before Yahweh, before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. He will, this magnificent line, he will judge the world, because there are two parts to it. He will judge the world in righteousness. That part's easy. We could say that without even understanding the more difficult part of this psalm. And the difficult part isn't difficult at all intellectually. We just don't like it. And all human beings, we just have a sort of resistance to it when we think we're the insiders. He will judge the world in righteousness. I can wag my finger at the world and say that. He's going to judge you in righteousness, world. You deserve everything coming to you. But it also says, and this is what we would expect here if it were saying what I wanted it to say. I mean, I as the people, right? And the people in his faithfulness. That's what we would think it would say. But it doesn't. It says the Amim, and the peoples in his faithfulness. In his faithfulness, in his truth, in his consistency, in his nature that never changes, and in the thing that makes him keep his covenant with us. His nature isn't different whether he's ruling over his people in Israel or his people in the church or his people that he created in the rest of the world. And I don't mean by that just his redeemed people. In the same way that Paul says it in the sermon on Mars Hill, he created all of us. God is the father of all of us. That doesn't mean he has redeemed all of us, but it does mean he regards us not only from righteousness, but also from faithfulness. The God who was faithful to love us when we were outside of him loves those who are outside of him now. And it creates a different perspective in the psalm. So I want to create the contrast. I don't necessarily have time to read the entire psalm to you to make the point. So you've got 13 verses in front of you. I'm just going to point out the differences. In 1 Chronicles 16, verse 1, the statement is this: sing to the Lord all the earth. And that would, now this is 1 Chronicles 16, verse 23. I'm saying verse 1 in reference to this psalm. It's the part of verse 1 from this psalm that's in 1 Chronicles 16. It's going to get really confusing if I have to do that every time, so I'm not going to do that every time. I'm just going to tell you the verse from this psalm and then read to you the part from 1 Chronicles 16. In this psalm, it's very simple. It is sing to the Lord a new song. In 1 Chronicles 16, it is sing to the Lord. And then it just goes on to all the earth, tell of his salvation from day to day, which is verse 2. So it's already gone on to the next verse of this psalm without a reference to a new song. It's a new song. That itself gives you the understanding that even whoever compiled this psalm and put it in the psaltery for us compiled it in a way to say, I know you know this psalm because it's in 1 Chronicles 16. We all sing it from there, but we're going to sing it a new way today. We're going to add some words to it. And you want to know what the other words they are that are added to it? In verse 6, instead of just saying in his place, it says in his sanctuary, instead of in his place. And it is that clear. In Hebrew, it's just as clear a distinction. In 1 Chronicles 16, when David is singing it, bringing the ark into Jerusalem, there's no temple. There's just a tabernacle. They're resetting everything so that you can just worship God there. It doesn't say, come into his sanctuary and do these things. It just says, come into this place and do these things. But here, it's in his sanctuary so that you have a special. And the same thing with the offerings that are being offered in verse 8. Ascribe, and again, that's in the psalm. It's in verse 8. Ascribe to the Lord, this is what it says in 1 Chronicles 16, the glory due to his name. Bring an offering and come before him. That's it. Just come before him. Here, it is come into his courts. You got courts to come into now. And in verse 13, the whole phrase, he will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness, it's not present. It is simply come, the trees of the forest shall sing for joy, as it says here, before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. That's it. He comes to judge the land. Not anymore. Now we understand. We've been out in the rest of the world. We've been captive in the places that told us we had to worship these false gods that we know are going to end up buried in the ground. And we don't, this is the thing, we don't respond to them by saying, oh yeah, well, God brought us back to our land now, and we're here, and na-na-na-na-boo-boo, you're going into the ground. God's going to bring judgment on you. No. We don't just end it by saying he's a faithful judge in this land, or he's a faithful judge in this land, and he'll judge the world in righteousness. But instead, we declare that he is going to judge the world here in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness. That is the creation, the whole of creation has a righteous creator and a faithful judge, a faithful sustainer, but a faithful judge, meaning he cares about them. It's more than vindication for us. It means hope for everyone. It's the same thing that happens with Jonah when he travels to Nineveh, literally the seat from where a king would declare that we needed to worship him instead of Yahweh. In that place, Jonah's lesson is, actually what Yahweh wants is their repentance. What he wants is for them to see that he is the creator, not Tiamat as the origin of everything, but Yahweh as the origin even of the heavens and the earth. And, you know, it's not a minor lesson that we learn in Scripture that this is the case. What Israel is constantly encountering, and this one's not even very strongly didactic about it. It's not a psalm that yells and screams at Israel and says, you hypocritical Pharisees, why don't you love the outsiders? It's a psalm that says, do you feel like you have a reason to celebrate the earth? Is it your power and might that causes you to celebrate what Yahweh has created? No, you have a reason to celebrate in this land. You have a reason to celebrate from the earth because Yahweh is great And do you think Yahweh is only great to you? I mean, he didn't just create you. He created you as a light to the world. He created you as a beacon. So stand up as a beacon. The people who are blessed, who've been brought back to the land, who've been brought back to a sanctuary, who've been brought back to courts to celebrate the Yahweh who cared about them, stand up and sing the song of how great Yahweh is over all the peoples. Not just you. The universality of that message and the centrality of it to the entire gospel is apparent in the passage I always pick out because it's so easy and concise to make the point in Ephesians 3 when we talk about the mystery of the gospel. I mean, he identifies it as the mystery of the gospel. This mystery, Paul says in Ephesians 3, is that the Gentiles are fellow heirs, members of the same body, partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the good news. Of this good news, I was made a minister according to the gift of God's grace, which was given to me by the working of his power to me, though I'm the very least of all the saints. This grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ. That unsearchable richness is exactly what we're singing about in Psalm 96. And we're supposed to be preaching to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ with Paul. That's what he's saying. And to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things. What? So that through the church and manifold wisdom of God might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. What? That the Gentiles are fellow heirs. He wants them in the cell. That doesn't mean there are no people in Israel who are not excluded because they rejected or because of their judgment. That doesn't mean there are no Gentiles who are rejected or judged. It's not a statement of universalism. And even if it were, it wouldn't change the value of this message. But it doesn't need to be that, and it's not that here. He is saying, though, that the message is for everyone, and the goodness of God is over everyone. It's included over everyone. You know, I think that that's so profoundly central to the message of the Old Testament and the New Testament. He's saying it constantly to Israel. I'm not doing it for your sake. I'm doing it for the sake of the nations where you've profaned my name so that my name can be sanctified among them and so on. In Ezekiel, for example, I'm just quoting the one from Ezekiel. It's everywhere in the Old Testament, and it's everywhere in the New Testament. The Gentiles come to Jesus. Oh, we're curious. The Greeks, they come. We're curious. We'd ask. The disciples don't want them to know, but Jesus wants them to know. The Syrophoenician woman, I would like to, would you just let me have the crumbs from under the table. The disciples, get rid of this woman. Jesus even plays along with them and invites them to think through the process and understand that they were dogs under the table too. Not in that many words, but that's the point of it. Over and over and over again. Same message. Why on earth would you give the same message over and over and over again? You know, because it's the one we don't accept. It's the one we don't listen to. It's the one we won't hear. It's the famous old story about the guy who gets called to a new church because he preaches an unbelievable sermon. They're amazed. And then the next Sunday, he preaches the same sermon after they called him as their pastor. And the next sermon, the next week, the same sermon. The next week, the same sermon. And finally, a deacon approaches him. You know, we love this sermon. It's amazing. But I mean, I think, don't you think, have you got another sermon? He says, well, when y'all start doing this one, I'll move on to the next one. I think that's what the entire Bible is. It's just one sermon. Love your neighbor as yourself and love your strangers around you as if they were born among you. It's a really clear message. It's very simple. And Jesus says it so simply. You know, what's the great commandment? That. And what do you mean by neighbor? Well, you know, the person you don't think of as one of you. That seems like, we need to add something to that. There's nothing to add to it. And you know why it has to be repeated so often? Because that's the sin we're best at. We're best at viewing ourselves as a little better and everybody else as not so good. I mean, that's in me every day, every single day. And I'm ashamed of it every time it rears its head and makes itself obvious. And I want to learn not to be that way because I want to hear a new song that God actually has given us. And if the old creation, and I'm done here, if the old creation is stubbornly committed to darkness and emptiness and frustration, then a new song may be just the thing we and all of that creation need.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.